It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is author and filmmaker John Maxwell. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Stuart. How are you doing?
We're here to talk about your book, Water Street, and we're also here to talk about three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. So, let us first delve into your book. And I guess the best place to start, and I should say, it's out now by BK Fiction. If you want to give a brief synopsis to what Water Street is all about before we get into any details about the writing of it.
Thank you. Thank you for the lovely intro, by the way. The Water Street is a mule kick of a Western, as I like to call it. I do argue with some people because they say it's historical fiction, and it is up to a point an historical thriller, but it has a lot of Western tropes in it. Even though it's a fictionalization, it's about something very real that happened in the 1860s. So let's go to 1863. It's the American Civil War. And in Liverpool, what is going on is there's something called the cotton drought, which is caused by, in the eyes of the nouveau riche in the cotton exchange in Liverpool, they're very, very powerful people. They're caused by the Union. So there was a blockade of the southern ports. The Confederate Navy wasn't really anything to talk about. So they weren't really able to stand up to this until, against British neutrality, essentially against the law, they started building ships in Camp Alert, sailing them out on the Mersey under a false registration, and then going to break the Union blockade, smash through them, these ironclad vessels. And Water Street really is about a sort of semi-fictional character called Bannister Dunwoody. He's based on a real guy called James Dunwoody Bullock, who comes to Liverpool with the intention of firstly building more ships and then ultimately drawing Britain into the war on the side of the Confederacy. And here's the kicker. Someone is spying on them. And that person who's spying on him happens to be his pregnant wife. So you've got intrigue, you've got noir, you've got a kind of Cold War type noir going on underneath it. And this reflects a lot of the stuff. It's like people are quite surprised about this in a place like Liverpool. But yeah, you know, it was quite a pivotal sort of setting, really, in the real story, but also in this. In terms of what was going on, you did have spies on both sides. You had consulates on both sides. So, you know, there was a sort of secret battle going on 4,000 miles away from the theater of war. They took it very, very seriously.
What was the kernel of the idea that set you off on a path to write this sort of fictional account of a important historical period in Liverpool's history?
It came from a few different angles. To be honest, it was, for me, it was low hanging fruit because, when I grew up with a painting on my mum and dad's wall, a print of an Atkinson Grimshaw, those beautiful Atkinson Grimshaw paintings. Anyone listening to this should go and check them out. It's, especially filmmakers, actually. I think, you know, painting and filmmaking have such a correlation. And it kind of, he nailed the Liverpool sky, this kind of really kind of purple bluish sort of hue over the city that you still get now. And this painting depicted the kind of the drag. It's now actually Liverpool One. So all that kind of modernity, all that glass and metal that's there now, there was these beautiful shops running up to the customs house on that drag. Three Graces didn't exist at the time. It was St. George's Dock down there, and the landing stage and Water Street were the kind of pivotal places in, well, not just in Liverpool history, but actually, Dan, I would argue, and this sounds kind of grandiose, but I would argue in world history in terms of trade, there's so many things came off that, you know, the Irish hunger, the surrounded docks, that it was kind of how to organize and ship goods, you know, particularly the slave industry related goods. So, you know, cotton, tobacco, sugar, you know, molasses and so forth, and banking, and massively so, banking and shipping. So you've got all these kind of industries sort of growing and burgeoning within probably a square mile around there. And of course, I get to find this out through, you know, looking at this painting and thinking about it and being interested in it and being a geek. I'm going, right, I'm going to go look into this and I'm going to find out what, you know, what's behind this. But also having a mother who grew up in Dingle and could tell me stories about going way back about, you know, relating to the Great Hunger. Some people call it potato famine. I think that's a wrong way of describing it. But you know, going back to that kind of disaster really in the mid 19th century. So I've always had a curiosity about the mid 19th century. I think it was not just in terms of, you know, British or the British Empire or Ireland, but the United States and how our countries were formed.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, I think it speaks to how young the globe is as we know it today, which we just take for granted. You know, you think of like around this time, you've got countries like Italy are being formed as a nation, Germany, all these places, Austro-Hungary Empire prior to this period. So suddenly individual states are being born out of what would have been covered under regal systems, I guess, not real. You know, democracy was breaking out, I suppose, is the
absolutely way. Absolutely. And this is the story of it. And actually, this is kind of, as far as I'm concerned, the gift that keeps on giving, because I'm going to go a little bit George MacDonald Fraser with Harry, my central character, and have her kind of grow from being a 22-year-old woman right the way through into her kind of 60s and 70s in my next few books. I've got it planned out because I want to kind of depict this period. It really is a kind of such a crucial period, and it's sort of, it's interesting for me because it just about predates the moving image as well. You know, and how influenced we are and how we judge history through the moving image. You know, it is, you know, photography in that decade in the 1860s went absolutely nuts. The American Civil War was one of the, you know, if you see some of this, the amazing and horrific photography that was taking place during the American Civil War. So, yeah, you know, there were quite a few different influences, but I also found out this one detail that just intrigued me, and it was the thing about the Confederate ships of all shapes and sizes, smaller gunships going through to, you know, big bruising fucking ironclad, you know, vessels that could smash through a kind of Union blockade, were being constructed in probably one of the most celebrated and richest shipbuilders in the world at the time, which was Campbell Laird and Birkenhead. I found that out and I thought, that is mad. That is just, that blew my mind. Since found out in the writing of the book, so many other things as well. You know, Lincoln was threatening war with Britain over that. That came through his... He dispatched one of his top allies, a guy called Haynes Dudley, to be the consul in Liverpool. And he's, you can still see the building still standing. It's still got the American Eagle above it on Paradise Street there. And Haynes Dudley was trying to subvert this action. He was trying to subvert it through the courts, but also by other means. He had his network of spies. So, you know, all of this action's going on. And meanwhile, you've got the Confederates who are trying to undo this. So I'm finding out all this crazy stuff. It's almost like a kind of Western town is going on. And these guys, these Americans on different sides, American spies are using Liverpool.
No, you're right. You know, just for the audience's benefit, and obviously to make you blush a little, you know, you write beautifully, and it's very vivid, the image that you conjure in the reader's mind as someone, I don't know Liverpool as well as you, but I've been to Liverpool a few times, and one of the first things as I'm beginning to read it, I'm going, I wish I could go and walk around Liverpool with your book. You know, look at your descriptions, and then look at what that place in Liverpool looks like. Because like you say, it's a real pivotal moment for the world where Liverpool's at the centre of it. That's what I mean. That's what I mean by Liverpool history. I don't mean it in a myopic sense, in the sense of it was at that point in history, there was, you know, to be between America and American civil, being on both sides of American Civil War, and Liverpool being a pivotal part of that story is bonkers to a 21st century audience. The idea that Liverpool, not London even, would be the more important link in the chain in terms of what's going to happen out of the USA. And the idea of the mercantiles, it seems from your book, have almost took power from London because they're making too much money, and who's going to stop them?
And there was a sort of, and I think, you know, so much of the building of the city at the time has hung on in a sense. You know, I think you've got this kind of, this passion and this kind of, some people have caught, you know, bullshit about victimhood and all that, you know, and that kind of has hung on for such a long time. But I think, you know, so many of the city grew through this influx in the 1840s and the 1850s through the, you know, the Great Hunger and this, you know, massive exodus that went on from Ireland, when it went down from 8 million people down to 5 million people. And that's 3 million people either died or had to get the fuck out, and they had no choice.
Absolutely.
No choice whatsoever. And the poorest of the poor, where do they go? They go to the nearest place that they can, and the cheapest passage. You know, if you wanted to go to America in modern terms, it would cost you about $3,000 per head. That's how much it would have cost to get in one of these barks, and you know, risk 30% chance of dying.
Basically coffin ships, weren't they?
Yeah, you're screwed. You know, you're boned. You know, you're going to lose a member of your family probably. Or at least one. But what was happening is such a high percentage were coming across in these boats. And for me, there was this crossover where you've got, if you were to walk around Liverpool in the 1860s, chances are most of the accents you would hear would be Irish.
Yeah.
The Scouse accent, as it is, probably didn't exist that much. It's sort of like a North Wales Irish hybrid. But, you know, It's just so interesting. I'm doing a symposium in the new year in the old Confederate embassy in Abercrombie Square.
Oh,
which
wow.
Is it's got like a South Carolina flag, I should say, in the kind of the skylight there. And it's actually I've got evidence from a University of Liverpool historian who was telling me the other day that Liverpool was going to be intended to be the main hub. If the Confederates had actually been more successful, they were going to make Liverpool the place in Britain, not London, Liverpool. And that's how much the design was. I mean, it was a metropolis at the time. It was, you know, there were people in London who were a bit worried about how Liverpool was growing, because it was insane. The speed the city was growing. So that there's all of these things are thrown into the pot, Stuart. And I'm just ever so slightly obsessed with it.
And what being sort of feeding on all that information that you're finding out, like you've got the stuff you kind of grew up with and knew about, and then you're suddenly finding out all this interesting background and context to what essentially is why Liverpool is today, but obviously what Liverpool was then. What was the challenge for you in terms of creating a story out of that and not getting too bogged down in trying to be so historically correct?
Well, the greatest gift I ever got for writing the novel was actually, and I'll say this, some novelists might blanch at this, but the greatest gift I ever got was teaching screenwriting,
which
in turn came from producing films and developing scripts and working in that kind of very rigorous sort of system. And I would argue screenwriting is probably the most rigorous form of writing in many ways. I wrote it as a treatment originally.
Okay.
And it was very rudimentary, very simple, really. It was kind of just more version of a long synopsis, like a three-pager rather than the treatments in the way. But yeah, I was always kind of intended to get it out there and get it, try and, you know, make it my, you know, kind of landmark project and all that. But, you know, I tried it in a couple of places. It was, you know, it was underdeveloped. I didn't have time. You know, I was too busy making films to actually get stuck into writing it, because it's, you know, in order to do a historical piece, it's not necessarily, you know, a kind of a contemporary thing where you can just kind of draw upon what you know already. You've really got to go in the way and do that research and dig out all the nuggets that you can. So I left it, shelved it. And then, of course, what happens is my wife fell sick. She had chemo.
Very sorry to hear that.
Couple of years. Yeah, she got, it was tough. And that overlapped with COVID. So she was like 2017, looking after her for ages, doing that and teaching at John Moore's as well. So lecture there in screenwriting and digital writing. And then, of course, COVID comes along and it's like, boom. And it's like, well, what are we going to do? You know, I'm not likely to be able to make a film. And I hadn't been able to make a film for a long time, apart from playing around with bits of animation. And I thought, well, if I carry on doing that, I probably will actually fall off the pitch and start gibbering like a maniac. Because it's so crazy just how much you're looking at the screen. So I better go away and write something. And that's what I did. I wrote Water Street. I started developing it during the kind of COVID era. Hooked up with an agent through a mate of mine, Jeff Young,
who's a
fantastic writer. And he sort of advised me to go to the Liverpool Literary Agency, and they are doing amazing things. They're the only literary agency outside. Well, they're not the only literary agency outside of London, but they're one of the very few in the north of England.
Yeah.
And they're doing wonderful things. And she just, Claire Coombs there, just encouraged me to keep going with it. And I did. And eventually we got a book deal, and here we are, it's moving, which is great. I'm really enjoying it, and just learning as much since the publication of the novel as I did in the run up to it, really, because now it's getting out there. I'm getting all kinds of people coming to me.
Brilliant.
With different, from the stateside as well. You know, I'm in touch with a voodoo priest who's given me lots of great stuff about New Orleans. It's apps, because a significant part of the book, I know you read it, Stuart, is this character called Conte, who is of Haitian sort of descent, and but the two main characters are sort of foundlings within it. Not too much of a spoiler by saying that.
Yeah.
And they kind of join the Choctaw tribe, and it's a sort of entry into them, into the story. And I've made this link up with New Orleans, with the Destrehan plantation as well, who's this French guy who was the kind of the master of the plantation, horrible word, but there you go.
Yeah.
During the Civil War, actually traveled to Paris to meet Napoleon III and begged him to join the war on the Confederate side.
Amazing.
So, you know, a lot of this stuff really happened. We came very, very close. You know, the British were tempted, if it wasn't for the fact that they'd just come off the Crimea and were a little bit battle-worn, and didn't fancy it, you know. But there were certainly a few voices there saying, you know, the Americans have got too big for the boots. So there was a lot of stuff going on. I've got to ask
John, of all what you perceived going into this and all that you understood, what for you was the most surprising thing you found out in your research of this book?
Um, There are a few things. I mean, there's a beautiful story. It was actually in Dublin over the weekend.
Right.
And this sort of underscored it, and it underscored it beautifully. The Choctaw tribe, they were the kind of tribe in Louisiana along the banks of the Mississippi. And this is very much Mississippi to Mersey. I'm kind of drawing a parallel between those two places.
Okay.
They were very much part of the Trail of Tears, where they were moved on forcibly. They were pushed out of the land. Massive parallel with what was going on in Ireland, you know, just in this style and the way, you know, pretty much criminals were turning up with more rights than them.
Effectively.
And then it was classic Wild West stuff. The criminals were the ones wearing the badges, you know. So I found this out, and they had this history going back in the 20 years preceding the American Civil War. And in the late 1840s, early 1850s, they gave money to the Irish. They actually they raised money and they gave it to the Irish. I still get a bit choked up even thinking about this. You know, these people have been fucked over. Not my French, but they've been absolutely, in a very short space of time, the lands have been, you know, cut apart. They'd been, they were being forced out of a place that they've been for thousands of years. By scumbags, essentially. And they heard about this famine. That was the so-called famine, but they heard about this disaster that was going on thousands of miles away, and they donated money. And I found out actually over the weekend, this is how these things have been coming to me by some kind of strange quirk of fate, that the Irish recently raised 5 million euros to donate back to them, for their grounds in Oklahoma.
Amazing.
So they've transferred that money back. And I just think, and there's an awful lot of stuff about, you know, the, as I said, the Camel Leg connection and the ships, the disgraceful thing about the ships being built and the massive support there was in the city. Shamefully, you know, this whole Liverpool Manc thing is quite funny because Manchester was more on the side of the Union, actually.
That's right, yeah.
Liverpool was on the side of the Confederacy, but not everyone was, I'll make a point that not everyone in Liverpool was on the side of the Confederacy, but there was a long lot, particularly, you know, in the moneyed sort of areas,
you can't escape how much the money would have influenced what people thought, as opposed to understood.
It was dreadful. And, you know, for me, you know, finding all this stuff out collectively was a way of making sense of who we are now as a city, you know, and many of the people who were left behind are the ones who are descending from, you know, those who weren't so well off, because the money did leave quite quickly, particularly after the Second World War. It was like, right, okay, that's it. There's nothing left. Boom, we're off. We've only started recovering as a population in the city in the last 10 years. It started to actually climb again. Up until like 2010 or something like that, the population was going decreasing.
I mean, it's really interesting over the last, I mean, this is a sort of a modern taking, I suppose, but the last 30, 40 years of what you would call sort of urbanization that's gone on, where cities have become important again, as opposed to everyone, you know, the whole donut theory where everyone just leaves the middle has been the savior for, you know, because it was where, you know, I guess affordable housing was. I mean, not anymore, but that was the initial pull, was that you could go into a city like Liverpool or Manchester and live quite happily. But then now it's...
Well, yeah, I've got ancestors who lived in the courthouses in Jamaica Street, which is actually near where the Baltic Triangle is now.
Yeah.
So that's where all these, you know, these beards are, and these these kind of, you can get your plate of chips on a skateboard sort of thing, like, you know.
Well, look, John, Water Street is out now from BK Fiction. I'll put a link in the show notes where people can get it from. And we will now move into...
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Three films that have impacted everything in your adult life. The rules are simple. For anyone not listening to this before, John has given me three titles. We are going to discuss the three titles, but only 5 minutes at a time. Your first choice, and I'm going to do them in the order you gave them, not the order they were released, is 1969's Midnight Cowboy, directed by John Schlesinger, starring John Voight and Dustin Hoffman. What is the importance of this film to you? Where does it fit in your film memories, John?
Well, I wasn't born in 1969. I was born a little bit after that. So I can't say, oh yeah, I went to see it at the old Ritzy. I didn't have the first wave of that film coming out. But films like this have got a sort of quality that, you know, I grew up in the 70s. And fortunately I had the kind of parents who used to let me watch anything. certification or, you know, safeguard and be damned. It was kind of a case of like, yeah, let him stay up and watch it. He's into it. Let him stay up and watch it. So, you know, and it was before we had video recorders. So, you know, Midnight Cowboy often did sort of appear on sort of network TV at the time. And I think that was my first experience on my mum and dad's cathode ray. And you think about it, and we were talking about this before we were doing the podcast here, about what a dark film it is.
Yeah.
And I was still, it was still perfectly fine for me to watch it. So my first memory, the very first time I watched it, I was probably about 6 or 7 years old, which might seem like a form of abuse, really. A little fellow with curly hair, you know, scarring him with, you know, some of the stuff that goes on in that film is, you know.
What can you remember about how you were computing this as a 7 year old? Do you remember any visceral reaction to it?
Yeah, I think for me, it signifies how much I love Westerns. And I at the same time, we'll talk about it later, you know, the kind of Sergio Leone thing, which is a similar sort of background. And that was what it was sold to me on it. Oh, Midnight Cowboy's a Western. I'm sure many people would have kind of caught on to that. But I think probably as I got older and watched it again and again, it sort of started to seep in some of the deeper themes in it. You know, I'm just seeing this kind of really dark portrayal of New York City when I was watching it as a kid and going, well, that's a scary place to be. And, it, you know, the place is as much a character as the characters are in
indeed,
that film.
Indeed.
You know, it's the place and time. It was really kind of, New York was absolutely freaking terrifying. You know, I went there in 1982 and it was still terrifying. I was only 10 in 1982.
Yeah.
But it was still had that kind of, that edgy sort of air. But it's one of the best things about it. It's one of the best things about that film. It's it's the nastiness in it. And it's not that I'm drawn to it in any kind of weird way, the nasty side of it. And the kind of, you know, I didn't really understand when I first saw it as a kid, you know, the whole idea of the gigolo thing and what Joe Buck does, and even the sort of the love relationship between him and Ratso. That's kind of been played up a lot, you know, in recent years, and rightly so, because that's a massive part of it. But I did see this kind of really odd, peculiar friendship between them, and I picked up on that, you know. And it sort of, it just stayed with me, you know. So I don't think I was particularly scarred by it, because I didn't understand a lot of the stuff that was going on as a six-year-old kid watching it late night on ITV. You know, but as I revisited it again and again and again over the years, and I have, you know, and I don't do that with many films, because I find it sort of sucks time away from watching something new, and it's like, you know, what's new, what's coming out, or reading something new. It really is. All three films are chosen the films that I'll revisit, because there's something in them. Yeah, you know, for me, a kind of emotional axis that really. It just kicks my stomach. It really does. But as I got older with it, as I got older with Midnight Cowboy, I did start to pick up on some of these things, you know. And you know, the absolute tragedy at the end, where he passes away, just as they're starting to go towards this kind of this fantasy, really, of Florida and all the, you know, the bright colours and all that. I mean, John Schlesinger is an absolute genius, you know, the way he portrayed all that. So yeah, Midnight Cowboy, amazing.
Indeed. Well, that was perfect 5 minutes there, sir. Yeah, it's a funny film in the sense of, I'm trying to picture like watching it as a seven-year-old, because you've got, and you can see how easy the kind of the darker subtexts to it can fly over you, because like the sex scenes are all like lurid and red, aren't you? They're not sexy in any way, are they? It's almost like sex isn't taken that seriously for a film about a gigolo. It's like, I think it is people versus New York City, and then the fantasy of the escape. New York City has ate them up and spat them out, and then the escape to Florida, isn't it, they're going to. Then and is this? It's just a fact. It's like you say, a fantasy, and a bit in a way. There's even though it's not a road movie. I mean, it turns into one, I guess, with the bus journey at the end. There's parallels with Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. It's just like the idea of people who've been displaced by what I guess is the start of we've not got an American dream anymore. There's just going to be this American nightmare, and you're all going to fall victim to it because neoliberalism is going to fuck you.
Oh yeah. And that was what was coming, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, as a 7 year old, I appreciate you weren't going to read that much into it, but yeah, I think it and. I don't think the filmmaker was making that comment, but you could only read that from what it's portraying of the time. You know, you've only got, what, 4 more years, 5 more years, then you've got Taxi Driver, which is repeating the same thing, really, is that we've lost control. Whatever it was we thought we were progressing to, it's going backwards. Well, look, sir, moving swiftly along, but jumping 3 years back in time to the third and final installment of the Dollars trilogy, The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, directed by Sergio Leone and starring Clint Eastwood and Lee Van Cleef, amongst others. Do you want to talk us through what, I mean, given you mentioned Western a lot in reference to Water Street, I can see where maybe this might feature, but tell us more.
Yeah, I'm going to be contrarian and kind of mention The Third Wheel and that, and it's Eli Wallach. I think Eli Wallach is the sort of... The trickster character, to borrow something from Campbell, watched this as a kid, and I was just drawn into him. Like, you know, I think I'd go into school, come out to people going, "Hey, Blondie," you know, all the time. It was just it so drawn to him, because what Leone did so well with not just this film, it's sort of like a symbol of many of his films, is he made bad characters good and good characters bad. He knew how to you know, package it convincingly within and have that kind of, you know, it almost in one sort of movement, that kind of change. you know, being able to see it. And I was drawn towards Eli Ward just as a rogue, just how clever the character is depicted. That, you know, he could have very easily been an awful stereotype. You know,
I guess Sergio's not falling foul to that horrible, to think about you as a screenwriting teacher and thinking how people look at screenplays, that horrible note of making someone more likable. Whereas that would have destroyed most of the characters in this
that
film,
obsessive
wouldn't it?
Obsessive note, yeah. Yeah, that would have been. And I suppose in a similar way to The Moonlight Cowboy, it's a film that just, one of its appeals was it wasn't sanitized. It just sort of, it laid it out flat in front of you. You know, there's a kind of simple plot and MacGuffin thing going on that's driving the whole thing through. And it's essentially three of them are kind of, you know, at different times joining sides with each other and going against each other. And it's so skillfully done. And it's just, again, for a kid watching it, and I'm going back to when I was a kid, because this is sort of a foundation. I'm realizing it more and more of what I've been writing, particularly recently. You know, where, you know, write the good buddy is essentially it. You know, if, I think a lot of films are only as good as the villains.
Yeah.
And if you can do that within one character, you know, if you can have the yin and yang and the you know, which you, probably less so with Lee Van Cleef, he's just an out and out shit heel.
Yeah.
And he's even got that sort of like that kind of Lynx type look about him, like, you know, which is so sort of iconic in that film. So yeah, I think it's the way it looks, it's the way he describes the wide open spaces and the sort of the feral nature of it and you know, so much of historically what I'm finding out underpins the growth of America, and particularly, you know, the Wild West as we see it is that land grab and that lawlessness.
It's like a divergence, you know, though, isn't it? There's this pressure to set up civil communities, but it doesn't take many people to destroy the civil community and reduce them to insecurity and paranoia so that you all end up being bad. It's like there's the obviously a lot of religious people went out and did their nice thing, but then it didn't take, God didn't protect them from all this nefariousness that was going on around them. And America is such a raw country, even to, you know, most of it, even to this day. You know, it's not been tamed. The West wasn't won, as it were. You know, there just was some cities rose and stayed where they were. But I think that what Leone does well is that idea of everyone's living on the wits, really. Nobody, who can you trust apart from the person who might have bought you a drink 5 minutes ago? And that's about as far as you can trust them.
And you think about it, you've got this Italian master, you know, who's shooting it in Spain in the Canary Islands. Using mainly a kind of Spanish or Italian speaking cast, apart from the three leads. And it shouldn't work.
No.
None of his films should have worked. None of his Westerns should have worked. You know, it should have been some kind of really mad pastiche. But it did.
It did indeed.
I would watch it again and again. Watch it in the cinema if you can.
I mean, just to dwell on it a second longer, like he manages to. I mean, I guess because of where it was shot, more as much as anything else. But he gets the uncomfortableness of never being cool, as in versus hot. Like his films, you know that everybody stinks of not having washed enough. That you know, the being near horses all the time. That you know, you feel that.
Smell of-
You feel
cheese
it. You feel it, don't you? He really gets that. He doesn't dress it. No, nobody's nice or likable, as we said. Well, look, moving 20 years back in time now to, and this is a really embarrassing admission for me, is that I've so often just called these films Powell and Pressburger movies that I just never knew what Pressburg, I mean, Michael Powell's first name, but I never knew Emmerich was Pressburger's first name till today, which is a bit of an admission from me. But, you know, yeah, every day's a school day, as it were. But 1943's The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, where, now this is a very, obviously a very different tone to the previous two. So where are you seeing this for the first time and why is it impacting on you?
I saw this in what was called at the time the Classic Cinema in Crosby, and I'm pleased to say it's actually still going. It is restored beautifully recently. It's now called the Plaza. It's a community run cinema.
Amazing.
If you're ever in that end of Liverpool, it's absolutely gorgeous. Opened in 1939, I think the week before war broke out, which is a bit crazy. And yeah, they again used to were in charge of curating and programming their films, you know, as long as I can remember. So yeah, you could go in there, see Star Wars or whatever, or Raiders of the Lost Ark, but they would show films like this. And you know, as a normal thing really. So there was kind of constant access as a kid to be able to go and see these type of films. And it started, I think it was some kind of season, because I think I saw A Matter of Life and Death, which is another famous Powell and Pressburger film on the TV. Again, my mum and dad's cathode ray beast in the living room is responsible for a lot of stuff. But I went to see it. I think it was a bit older. I think it was about 1983, 84 in what was called the Classic at the time. And for me, it was just a spectacle. It wasn't, you know, any kind of chin stroking, you know, pretentiousness as I saw it. It was just that, you know, I loved The Matter of Life and Death, and I knew there was a connection. There was the same people behind it. And I hadn't quite got around to Black Narcissus or Red Shoes at that time. But so, you know, rainy Saturday afternoon, went down there with my mate. And we sat in there. I wasn't expecting much. And it was like, what? This is a colour film and made during the war. It was just electric. It was just beautiful. And you know, again, it's a similar thing to very much the Midnight Cowboy, I suppose, that I probably didn't understand all the nuances, but I was taken on this kind of journey through time, really, and that's what it is. It goes from the Boer War all the way through to the Second World War, which is a fundamental period of history. And it's about friendship as well, much as, you know, Joe Buck and Rizzo, but friendship, the, you know, Candy and Theo, and the Deborah Kerr characters, you know, as well, you know, very much about friendship and, you know, against really, really, you know, troubled times, and the survival of friendship. And I think that's probably what I always latched onto. So, it's another film that I was exposed to quite early when I was young. I'm so grateful that I was, because it sort of stuck in my memory. And, you know, I still revisit it. I still go back to it. I'll still even show clips of it to people, you know, to students who'll want to see like the next Jordan Peele or something like that. Like, and I'll go, right, well, you know, hang on, that's great, but have a look at this, you know, just because it is timeless. It's a beautiful story of friendship. I am still flabbergasted to this day how it never got hit by the censors.
I was going to say, what do you think? I was going to say, made during the war, and it's literally about wars. Yeah. What I mean, what's it?
43. Yeah.
So what's it saying?
It's portraying a good German. Now, you know, Spielberg might be able to do that in Schindler's List, you know, so many years after the fact, and it's all like, you know, we're all friends now, that kind of thing. Yeah. So, and don't get me wrong, in the sense that added brave elements as well, but you know, this is right in the middle of it. This is all the shit going on, and they shot it beautifully. Jack Carter's cinematography is utterly stunning. You know, it's just, you know, the use of very, very new techniques of color. It was just, you know, it just takes you there all the way through. And I suppose You look at that portrayal of friendship. That's what really draws me through. But you almost don't notice the stuff like the colours and the cinematography. It's just out of this world.
I've got to ask you, now you've told us about the film, I know the alarm's gone off for 5 minutes, but so what's the cinema like now then? This place in the Plaza, you said it's called now. So what kind of venue is it?
Well, not by Mesha that, but by a few people, they unkindly called it the Flea Pit, which I believe was a generic term for a place that was a bit of a dump. I don't know how the hell they kept it going, like these volunteers, but they deserve a bloody medal too, honestly. Out of passion involved in keeping a place like that going. But since they got a grant and restored it, it is a fantastic place to go and watch a film. I mean, it's a different feel to going into multiplex or, you know, and I know there's this trend in multiplexes, like, you know, for, you know, sofas and lovely comfy chairs and all that, and, you know, Dolby surround and bloody, bloody, blah, 4K. And they've got all that there. They've got all the, you know, the kind of wow projection, digital projection, all of that is in there now. It's installed, but it's just the surroundings of it. There's nothing to match the collective experience of watching a film, you know, with other people in an environment like that. Thankfully, you know, here's my little advert to Crosby Plaza Cinema on Liverpool Road in Crosby. If you're ever in Liverpool or if you're from Liverpool, do pay it a visit. And it is cheap to go and watch a film. I'm talking £4.
I will put a link in the show notes. I think it's an important thing. This is one of the things, you know, old video shops and old cinemas is certainly something I love to hear about in terms of this section of the podcast. But if a cinema's still going to this day, then it always deserves a shout out.
That's right. Thank you.
Well, look, we've come to the end of your three films that have impacted everything in adult life. And thank you for sharing with us the writing of Water Street. Congratulations on that.
Thank you for having me, mate.
My pleasure. And it just gives me, in fact, before I do say goodbye, let me take advantage of you as a screenwriting lecturer or teacher, whichever way you want to put it. What's one bit of key advice that you like your students to go away with in those first couple of weeks when you're trying to get them to get their head around what screenwriting is?
Don't get too hung up on structure. Don't. Free your mind. Go for it. If it's a load of bullshit, it doesn't matter. You know, you just need to get it down, because then the magic starts to happen. The research starts to happen. You know, you can do research at any stage in writing the screenplay, but the most important thing at the beginning is get the passion, you know, because if you haven't got the passion, it'll show straight away. It'll be fake. So, you know, get passionate. All the clever stuff, all the kind of, you know, the micromanaging, the layering, give it a longer piece or whatever, that comes later. But really, you know, don't worry about to paraphrase talking about Stop Making Sense.
Well, there's a screenwriting podcast called The Screenwriting Life. And what you've just described, they talk about it as just jump in the lava. That's how they describe it. It's like, don't be afraid of jumping in. Not knowing what you're going to write and how it's going to turn out is not a bad thing if you've got this kernel of an idea that you want to get down. And it's about discovering it when you're in the lava. You know, you won't discover it by thinking about it. You have to put something down on paper, or else it is just a thought. Well, I'm glad you did that, and I'm sorry to have just thrown that at you. But I think that's some good advice there. So it does give me just to say thank you very much for joining us on the BritFlix podcast.
Thank you, Stuart.
Yeah. Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.